say this, that we do need now to get on to the next item on the agenda, which is further engagement on NIPS and the DTI response to outstanding questions. Just for the record, members, all of us here on the left, as indicated earlier to you, we have no intention of putting, according to media reports, the lid on anything. What we do intend pursuing is the procedures of Parliament, which I think all members would like us to do. Having said that, we indicated already to the Minister and DTI that we would like as full a response as possible. As I said at the last meeting, I was of the opinion that you would get everything you required from the Minister and his team. I've no doubt you will. Thank you very much. It's good to see we are all back on track. If I may now hand over back to DTI.
Chair, let me just start off by saying that I believe there was a procedural matter which got stuck here. Perhaps I should have said at the beginning that I'm so pleased to see that the Honourable Mania is interested in issues of industrialisation and economic development of the country, that he's come to join this committee. I didn't realise he was a member of the committee, and I'm sure that that's what he was here for. But I was just going to say that we understood there was a procedural matter of a document which is a document of ours, the DTI, and we are releasing it to public. We're not going to stand in the way of that. And just to say, the questions will be answered in detail by the team, by Nimrod Zalk in particular, and other members of the team. But I just wanted to say that on the question of the NIPS, we have indicated that as part of the overall reform of procurement, that we are in a process of also reviewing the NIPS and reviewing the NIPS to make sure that some of the ambiguities about where they apply, the national government only or national, provincial, local government, state-owned entities and things of that sort would be removed, and also to make sure that there was much greater delivery in the sector or area where the procurement took place, so that it can support what we're seeking to achieve, which is procurement that supports localization and local manufacturing. That exercise is ongoing. Insofar as the contracts for the strategic defense procurement were concerned, none of us who are sitting here at this moment in time were responsible for the determination of the terms of those contracts, and some of the obligations are defined in multiple units like sales, exports, investment, and sometimes those are all run together. There's direct and indirect jobs, and sometimes those are all run together, and also run together in terms of jobs created during construction and during the operation. If that's the case, that's not. We have been operating very strictly according to what are the requirements in the obligors. I think except for one of them, then now the obligations have been fulfilled such as they were, and there has been no intention or action on the part of the DTI to try to allow anybody to not deliver on those obligations. It's been our intention to ensure that those obligations are delivered as they were defined in the contracts that we inherited. So I think that's those are the observations I make at the beginning. And then there were a set of outstanding questions. I wasn't even at the previous meeting, so I don't know what all the questions were, but I think we're handing over to the team there led by the DDG.
Thank you, Chair.
detailed answers on. The first chair was on what are the total estimated jobs that were created through the industrial, the NIP program to date, since its inception. We have gone back and pulled out those numbers. In terms of new direct jobs, it was 16,917. What we do, as we do with when we calculate the indirect job impact in terms of all other industrial policy interventions, is we apply a very conservative indirect job multiplier of two indirect jobs to one direct job, which gives a number of 33,834 indirect jobs, and in other words, a total of new jobs created of 50,751. In terms of the overall target of 65,000 jobs, this amounts to 78.1% of the target. It is also important to make the committee aware, Chair, that in addition to the new jobs, there were around, well, according to our figures, 15,404 jobs saved or retained as a consequence of the program. And although we haven't specifically calculated that, of course, if those jobs had been lost, the multiplier would have operated in the, similarly with respect to jobs lost, and there would have been a very large amount of consequential job losses had those jobs not been saved or retained. The second matter was there was a question when the program was designed in 1996, what countries were included in the benchmarking against which the program was designed. These were Abu Dhabi, Australia, Canada, Denmark, Greece, Kuwait, the Netherlands, Philippines, Saudi Arabia, South Korea, Taiwan, the United Arab Emirates, and the United Kingdom. I think the next area, Chair, was there was a request for a bit more of a description of how monitoring is undertaken, and I think also how this will tie in with the project review which we announced to the committee in the previous session on NIP, when we also briefed the committee on the policy review that had been undertaken. Essentially, how monitoring is undertaken as part of the NIP program is that the obligors, as I understand, on an annual basis, are required to submit audited statements on the progress of the project. In addition, the NIP team does various site visits in order to, you know, also check the veracity of the information that's provided. However, as we indicated in the previous session, given that you know, we're now at a very advanced stage of this particular phase of the industrial participation program, it is appropriate to undertake a detailed project review, and that means going back project by project, undertaking effectively an audit of all the projects, and looking at what did the obligors say up front they would do with respect to those projects. Were these commitments met? If not, why? And if this was due to some kind of act or omission by the obligors, then we would need to take appropriate action. And of course, this
address some of the matters arising from the reference to this report. Of course, we did not have prior sight of this report at the time, and that is one of the reasons why we requested the committee that we be able to go back and and look at the what the issues were that were raised. We were subsequently provided with this extract, which on the one hand we take very, very seriously, and we certainly will feed into the process of the project review. It is, however, fairly limited in detail, Chair, and I think as people will see, and I don't think it provides us with the level of detail that we would actually want in relation to to some of the statements that are made in this document. One of the things that the report does itself address was a question that was raised by the from within the committee, which is there was an obligation of 2.85 billion euros, and the report itself is very, very clear in its understanding that that an obligation of 2.85 billion euros does not require a corresponding investment of the same quantum, but that according to the rules of the program, which are very well documented, there's a system of multipliers, which and my colleague will elaborate on that, and that the ultimate investment that was put in place by Ferrosol was in the order of about 63 million euros. The document lists projects, a number of projects which it deems were questionable or believed had failed. I think the first point to make, Chair, is that obviously there were a number of projects under this particular set of obligations. The majority of those projects, to the best of our information and to the best of our understanding, have been successful. I can give examples, for instance, of three projects. In fact, we worked very, very closely with the Western Cape provincial government in getting these projects off the ground in Saldanha, a yacht launching facility, and two facilities that relate to the servicing of oil and gas exploration activity on the west coast of Africa, including an offshore fabrication site and a repair and maintenance facility. There have been projects which have not been successful, Chair, and again, to the best of our knowledge, some of those projects have not been successful for reasons that, at least on the information presented to us, have not been due to the conduct of the obligor. But again, I think the project review will go back and also revisit this. So one project, for instance, is the Mugwa Tea Estate. We know that, members may have seen, for instance, there was a very detailed article last week in the Mail and Guardian that pointed out, some of the complex problems that have beset that project, which really fundamentally have nothing to do with this program, but have to do with kind of conflict between management and employees on the Mugwa Tea Estate. One of the projects that was mentioned was SAMES, which was an electronics other was this proposed condomie facility, where really it appears to have been as a consequence of poor management that the project did not go ahead. So, Chair, I think the as we indicated, the we need to, as a as part of this project review, look very, very carefully at, first of all, ensuring that we double check that where it's claimed, it's been claimed that the obligations have been fulfilled, that they have indeed been fulfilled. Where they have not been fulfilled, that we need to establish why that was the case and whether it was due to kind of external factors or whether it was due to some kind of mission or act by the obligor themselves. So I think, Chair, that those I think some of the broad issues that I would wish to address. I'm going to ask my colleague Masazaki Zamela to address two I think other outstanding issues which were raised. The one is just to be clearer about the multiply methodology and why it was that the kind of multipliers that were awarded to the Ferrosol project were indeed awarded. And then also there was a question about obligors who have not met their targets by the due date and who are those. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much. Over to the committee to raise their questions now.
Mr. Zimela.
DG, sorry. My apologies, DG.
Thank you, Chair. Thanks,
Zimela. Thank you.
The question that was raised was the issue around how multipliers work. But let me go there to the issue of credit, the credit system that we use. When companies get an obligation, we use a system which says they must fulfill their obligation through economic activities. And we use a credit system in the sense that when they invest, we give them credits for investment. some in nuclear, some in technical skills. So some obligors contributed to the training process, and that money was not going to work in the form of a grant. So we negotiated higher multipliers. Specifically in relation to Ferrostar, there are certain projects that they've put in grants, loans. So in all of those projects, we've negotiated based on some of these issues that I've mentioned, whether it's a grant, it's a low interest loan, and also in some situations where we felt that their contribution would save a number of jobs, like the time that they're investing in Magwa tea, the Magwa plantation is about to be closed. So their investment helped to prevent a loss of jobs. So we negotiated different multipliers for all of those projects. I think the average multiplier, I mean the average multiplier for Ferrostar is the question around what was the average multiplier. The average multiplier was 40. That was the multiplier for investment and sales. If we exclude sales, the multiplier for investment, the average is 15. Turning to the issue of companies that did not meet their milestones or have not fulfilled their obligations, the two companies that have not met their milestones so far is Beretta, which supplies the guns to the SAPS and the SNDF, and MDSI, which supplies electronic equipment, software equipment to telecom. These companies have put in projects, but due to certain circumstances, like the economic crisis, they have not been able to achieve the sales that they were expecting, and they have not met their milestone. We are in discussions with them in terms of putting in substitute projects that will enable them to meet their milestones. And the companies that have not signed the obligation, one company is the Strategic Partner Group, which was part of the Gautrain Bombela Consortium. It's a BE part of the Bombela Consortium. They've struggled to come up with one, they've struggled to come up with performance guarantee. Two, they've struggled to come up with the projects that are needed to satisfy the obligation. I think that's purely because the group was set up specifically for the Gautrain project. It was not at that time an existing company that has got operations. We are in discussions with them as well in terms of trying to correct that situation. Then the other company that has not signed the obligation is Internet. It's a Russian company, the Russian government-owned company supplies nuclear fuel to ESCOM. There's been quite a lot of technicalities around their refusal to sign the obligation, and we've taken up the matter by national commission between the government of South Africa and Russia, and we hope that that situation will be sorted out. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Chair, if I could just add one point of clarity on the document that the Minister referred to. It is not in fact a DTR document. As I indicated, it is a Ferrostar document derived from some kind of Ferrostar internal inquiry. But again, to reiterate, I mean, we would not object as DTR prior to that document being put in the public domain, that particular extract.
Thank you very much for the moment, DTI. And now it's over to members in our own committee. Honourable Jordan Hill, followed by, just as you know, Honourable Mania, we do the full time members first. Honourable Elders, Honourable Khadebe, Honourable Mania.
Thank you very much. The document which you gave us in September, the progress report on NIPS at the time, contains radically different credit amounts than the one that you've given us today. In most cases, multipliers in their late 40s have been reduced to multipliers of anywhere between 10 and 30 or 10 and 20 something. Why is there a radical difference in a change in the multipliers all of a sudden? And then secondly, with regards to, you mentioned some countries that you benchmark yourself against, and you read out a fairly quick list. The information that I have at my disposal, for example, you read out the United Arab Emirates, they don't use multipliers. The United Kingdom, you read out, they don't use multipliers. Taiwan, you read out, they use multipliers of between 1 and 6 only. Australia, you read out, they use multipliers of between 1 and 6 only. And I missed some of the others on which I have got information. I don't have information on Abu Dhabi. It would seem, though, that even these revised and reduced multipliers, which you've given us today, are significantly more than the international benchmarks. That's the second thing. The third thing is some kind of transparent policy on how you decide on these benchmarks. Is it published anywhere? Many of the countries that you mentioned that I've just read have got published benchmark policies available online. That's where I got the information. You can go and see what their multipliers are. You can go and see how exactly they are applied and how they decided on. Thanks, Jen.
Thank you very much, Honourable Hill Lewis, Honourable Elvis.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, I also would like to know exactly how the multipliers are calculated. What is the policy, the internal policy that you follow, and there must be some sort of system that you follow, and whether that's publicly available. And then also just with regard to MDSI, does MDI still exist? Because I know they've been taken over by an American company. They used to be Canadian. Why have they not actually delivered their obligations as required? And what are the nature of the discussions that you've entered into in terms of finding some sort of a alternative for them? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Elbert. Honourable Khadebe.
Chairperson, a person will appreciate this response to this question, because I think that the responses are very comprehensive to the question we asked before. In particular, I like the part where even that document is being released, because I think that what is critical here is that as the South African state, we believe in transparency. Our constitution believes in that. But what is also critical is the respect for the human rights. As the committee has reported before, that we must get the permission from the originator of this document so that it can be. So I think it's very good. But what also I like with this presentation, it goes to the heart of the issues which we are grappling with as a country. From the previous presentation we had from the department, it was clear that there was a problem when coming to the issue of the cost of capital for the country. One in particular, when we're doing industrial investment, the cost of capital thereof. I'm happy that when coming to the issue of the multiplier effect, that thing is considered, in particular when an obligator gives interest-free loans. because we know that the cost of capital within the country is one of the things which make us not to be competitive. Because when you go to the countries like Brazil, you'll find that when we are industrializing, you find that the interest rate which we pay is far less than what the ordinary citizen is doing. So if the obligators are sometimes committed to give them interest-free loans, and then actually interest-free loans, actually even start projects, put the capital up front for the emerging market, I think that it goes hand in glove with our project of industrialization. That's why that one will be highly recommended. I think that the person will have to, a liberal attitude towards that. But what is critical, Chair, is that when those decisions are taken, I think that there must be transparency so that the people, as the decision is being taken, the people must be informed that now we're going to deviate from this because it will as if something is done under the table. Yeah. We are deviating from that because of what we pay for. I think that once we have that transparency, it will be better. When I ask the questions of the benchmark check on that one, I'm happy that the UK was quoted as one of the countries because I was really interested in the way in which the UK operated. And then you find that there are certain things which you must not learn from the UK. I can make an example. When coming to their own arms deal to Saudi Arabia, the Honorable Premier of Britain, Honorable Tony Blair, actually squashed the investigation and took it under the carpet. Now, I'm very happy that the South African government is bold enough because the President said, no, we'll have a commission. If there's anything wrong, it has to be there in the public so that we prevent this thing from occurring. So I think that on the average, we are moving on the straight and narrow, but we can even do more narrow as we're moving forward. Thank you, Chair.
This is just the broadest of comments, then. Honourable Mania.
Thank you, Chair. I know that you pressed for time, and I'll be brief. We find ourselves in this briefing, Chair, because, and I'm sure the Minister will accept this, there's been a decade-long, or in fact more than a decade-long, struggle to get a detailed and proper report on the NIFs. There has never, until September last year, and to the credit of the Minister, been a detailed report on the National Industrial Participation Programme in respect of the arms deal. And it's precisely for that reason, Minister, that I think there is a public perception that the National Industrial Participation Programme in respect of the arms deal was a monstrous political fraud. And I think that it's evidenced by the response to our questions from the department, where in 1999 there was a pledge, for example, that 65,000 jobs could be created as a result of the NIP. Today we hear that, in fact, that is not what happened. 16,917 jobs were created. And so there is a question. But the three unresolved, or the three issues on which we focused at the last session, were really the pledge made in 1999, the whole question of the German frigate consortium's obligations, and then finally the Long Walk to Freedom movie. Now, if we come to the first issue, the pledge in 1999. The pledge in 1999 was that the National Industrial Participation Programme, or the arms deal, would create 65,000 jobs and 110 billion rands worth of investment. We understand that in respect of the jobs, 16,917 jobs were created. My question then is, how much investment? What was the total actual investment? That's the first question. When it comes to the German Frigate Consortium, the German Frigate Consortium gets a credit for a total obligation of 3 million euros. The question that we posed last year was, how much was actually invested? And that presumably is the sum of the first column of figures in your table. How much was actually invested? Then when we come to the Long Walk to Freedom, the movie, which was a project which fell under the German frigate, German submarine consortium's obligation. We see that there was an actual investment of 7.5 million euros. But if you look at your September report, there was a total credit of 300 million euros. How can that possibly be? Could you explain that? Thank you. Chair, just to say, I mean, as an ordinary member of the security cluster, not the economic cluster, it appears to me that this is, frankly, voodoo economics.
What?
Voodoo economics.
Yes, I wasn't too sure whether I was on one of the islands or not, so I was just doing a clarification, because I generally associate that outside South Africa, be that as it may. Is that it then? Thank you. Over to you, Minister.
Let the team answer first, I'll say something. Thanks, Chair. Let me first address the question on the difference in the credits. I'd requested that this table include the full credits, including the sales credits. I think the reason why it was circulated with only the investment credits is because it's subject of a parliamentary question which had asked specifically about the investment credits. But Chair, we'll come back very rapidly to the committee and include the sales credits, and I think that accounts for the difference in the total and the multipliers. I wasn't around at the time, so I don't know precisely what elements of the benchmark benchmarking exercise that gave rise to the design of the NIP covered. I'm sure that it looked at a range of factors, including multipliers, and so the benchmarking took place, presumably looking at a range of factors around how these kind of projects are designed. So, but what I think we can say, Chair, I think is that we need to take on board, I think, the comments that that as we strengthen the program going forward, which we are in the process of doing, that we look at being more precise about these are the multipliers that you get for particular kinds of activities, and possibly placing a cap on those multipliers for particular activities. I'll ask my colleague to address the MDSI question and the Long Walk to Freedom question and the question about the total investment. Sorry, Chair. I'm just trying to scan through the other questions that were raised. Again, on the jobs, to reiterate, the calculation of jobs is based on the direct calculation of direct jobs created, together with indirect jobs effect with a very conservative indirect job multiplier, and it excludes, although it's very important to take note of, the 15,000 or so jobs that were saved or retained, direct jobs that were saved or retained as a consequence of the program. So I think we've explained quite clearly how the jobs figures are derived.
Thanks. The question about MDSI is set up a company to develop modules for its operations worldwide. But when the economic crisis hit, there was less need for those software modules, and the local
actual investment is $2-3 million. For TSC, the actual investment is $44.4 million. TSC is the German frigate consortium. For Thales, which we supplied the combat suit, the actual investment is $139.7 million. For Augusta, which supplied the light helicopters, the actual investment is $49 million.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much, the Minister.
Thank you very much. I mean, I think what I want to say is that we are trying to be as far as possible play open cards on this matter, because I think that the nature of the deal that was negotiated has been a source of lessons to us in terms of improving the performance of the NIPS. I'm not sure whether, I've been trying to query whether there was $110 billion of investment as such, because one of the things, I happen to have been the chair of the portfolio committee when the multi-agency report was discussed by Parliament, since been demoted, but at that time, this is what we said that things called benefits were all stuck together and somebody added them up, and they were amounts in terms of investment, amounts in terms of sales, amounts in terms of export. It's like adding apples and bottles of water and pens and coming up with some total, which is not in fact a meaningful total. And what you needed to do, they were all milestones, but if you add them all up, then that isn't giving you a very accurate picture of what's going to be delivered. Similarly, on the jobs, I think, as has been mentioned, was the same observation was that these were not only were the direct and indirect jobs, it was also jobs in construction, jobs in the actual operation of the investments. So it was jobs that existed at some time, they disappeared, then other jobs replaced them. They were all added together, and it was and you came up with some total. Now, whether that influenced anybody to make a wrong decision about the arms deal is a matter that the inquiry, frankly, is going to have to deal with. But the point is that the obligations are defined in these multiple ways. I think that's the point. And also the fact of the matter is that we bought submarines and we get somebody investing in a condom factory or something like that. Now, I do recall when we were in the portfolio committee, somebody said, what's the connection? And the only connection that we could come up with was perhaps Randy Sailors, but that's not really... The point is that... Eh? Yeah, is it
a former submarine officer.
but I think the point is that we are in the process now as part of the of in fact the broader procurement thing. We're trying to change this program. Now I think it's already been conceded, and maybe we need to think about this. Some of these multipliers. What is the basis? I think the team needs to come back a bit and explain some of that, but also. Also, some of them look on the face of it to be quite large. So why are they there like that? And do we need to put caps on them? I think that's the issue that's coming up. We also, I think, need to see much more activity directly in the area concerned. If we buy, let's say we buy civilian aircraft, we want to see work taking place in the aircraft industry, that sort of thing. I think we want to see much more of that. So I think this was perhaps one of the first major procurements by government that tried to use this program. I'm not surprised that there are a number of areas that we can, with the benefit of hindsight, identify for improvement and for a substantial overhaul, even, let me say. But whether there was any culpability, as I said, that's not our business. That's another inquiry. And as far as we are concerned, we do want to see, insofar as the contracts were defined, we have no interest in letting anybody off. We have every interest in getting everything that everybody's agreed. So I think that's basically it. And so I think that if the that's why we want to be transparent. Let's see what it is. Let's see what they promised us. Let's see what if they're delivering on what they promised us. Whether we can go back if there's been a negotiation and there's been a high multiplier that perhaps in a future contract we wouldn't want to give. We can go back now and say, no, we're not going to give you a 30 multiplier, we're going to give you a 3. I think that probably is a little bit too difficult for us to do. It would involve us. And the document, well, you know, as the DDG says, not our document, but insofar as we are a stakeholder, we are, you know, we don't have a problem. We're not standing in anybody's way of getting those documents because, you know, we don't have anything to hide. Madam Chair, if I could just then round up on the point about the multipliers and the methodology. I think, as was correctly mentioned, there are many countries which don't have multipliers. And the reason for us, as I said, this guidelines was introduced via a cabinet memorandum in 1996. Now, as you know, we have what is called direct offsets and indirect offsets. Now, in most of the countries, we're one of the few countries that have this system for non-industrial and non-defense. So, for example, in the UK, they only apply it for the defense industry. They don't do it for Airbus. They don't do it for the electricity sector and so on. So they only do, and even in this deal itself, there are two parts to the obligations. There's what is called the NIPS, which is indirect, and then there's the DIPS, which is the direct defense, which is managed by the Department of Defense. There they have much less or no multipliers. So the reason we have multipliers in our program is because it was decided that we should try to encourage not investment in the defense industry, but try to do it outside people's core business. So what you were trying to do is you were trying to get companies whose core business is in one sector, and that's why. So usually the multipliers applies to the concept arose to get people to invest outside of the defense industry, but as it was indicated, we've probably moved beyond multipliers now. I think the new NIP guidelines that we're preparing is that we're asking for direct offsets now, that you must invest in the sector you get. So if we get an obligation from Airbus, they must do it in the aerospace sector. If Haltrain does it, they must do it in locomotives and so on. So I think that we learned that lesson. But remember in 1996, the question of leveraging procurement wasn't an accepted norm, not internationally or in South Africa. And as I said, it's the first phase, but I think we've probably moved beyond that system now.
I think I'm just reminding Honourable Jordan, Hill Lewis and Mania, not that I'm stopping you from raising your question, that I would agree that we certainly would like to get just a further clarification on the multiplier type of issue and this. And I've just spoken to the secretary of the committee to clear some space right early in the next session, quarter. But over to you, Honourable Hill Lewis.
Thank you, Chair. Just on that point, there's actually, if you study the offset policies of various countries that are available online, there's many countries that have got non-industrial offsets, not just defence offsets. I want to say on the multipliers, Chair, once again, Mr. Zalk has confirmed that these multipliers are in effect wrong. They are much less. They are much less here than what they really are, because these investment credits don't take into account sales credits. Now, I'm not sure why, if a project has been allocated a multiplier, and the department knows what that multiplier is, why is it all useful for us to be given a different multiplier, which is much less than the one that's actually the real multiplier? These are the kind of things, Chair, that perpetuate the perception that, rightly or wrongly, that the department isn't always playing completely open cards. The fact is, if you do the numbers from this document, your September document, most of these multipliers do range in the region 40 and up. And again, if I go back to the international benchmarking, I promise you, from the information available, we are the only country in the world using such high multipliers. The highest that I can find was, I think, Bulgaria using 15. We are much, much higher than that. So, Chair, we've got to get the proper information and full information.
Thank you, Honourable Hildu. Honourable Mania.
Chair, I have a comment, a request, and a question of clarification. My comment really is, I mean, I must compliment the Minister. I mean, the Minister has said that he is trying to play open cards. I don't think that we have all the information we require yet, but we do have, particularly as a result of the report in September, more information than we have ever had before. I would think, through you, Chair, that it would be in the public interest if the Minister considered simply providing this committee and the public with a full report of each obligator, each project, and how the total credits, including investment credits and sales credits, were calculated, and how the final credit was arrived at. Then all the information is out there. I think that is something that perhaps the Minister should consider. That's the first thing. The second thing then, just a question for clarification. I mean, I must ask, come back to the Long Walk to Freedom. I mean, the Long Walk to Freedom, the movie, has a total credit of 3,228 jobs. We don't know if those are direct or indirect jobs or a combination. They probably do a combination. And a total credit of 300 million euros. Again, presumably calculated as a result of investment and sales credits. But what we've heard here is, in fact, that there's no movie. There's no movie. The movie production will only start in May 2012. So my question is, if there was no movie and no production, how then was it possible for the German Frigate Consortium to be awarded a credit by the department? I would, just again, as an ordinary non-economist, I would think that you would get a credit for
that.
Yeah.
Chair, again, and I don't really understand why there's any lack of clarity on this point. I had instructed that the full set of credits be put out. Clearly, unfortunately, that didn't happen this morning, and we've indicated that we will rectify that in the next couple of days. So I don't think there's any kind of uncertainty on that matter. I think then the and again, I think we've addressed the multiplier issue in that we have said very, very clearly that as we review, we're in now the final stages of review and strengthening of the program, that we need to look quite seriously at, you know, at what levels do we set, what kind of multipliers do we set for particular activities, and let's be clear about that and what the cap on those multipliers is. I'll ask my colleague then to talk to the Long Walk to Freedom, but I mean in terms of the full the full report on all the obligors, all the projects, the various credits and the multipliers, I think that's we will readily make that available.
Thanks, Madam Chair. The way we operate in terms of allocating credit, if it's a kind of investment, once an obligor has put in the investment and we can 7 years. Then we gave them seeds up front for normal tools. The issue about jobs, I think we have corrected. The earlier figure that we sent last year of 3,000 was an estimate. I think we have corrected it now to 59, which have already been created, and we haven't put in, that's why there's a revision in the number of jobs. We haven't put in the 10,000 that is an estimate. We'll only put once those jobs are created. Thank you.
Right. Now, just I do want the department to realise time is against us. Honourable Minister.
Thanks. I was just going to say that, the commitment that comes from me is that we'll be transparent. There's a very good reason for that. The Minister and Honourable Khadevi said that the President has announced an inquiry. So if we hide something now, we're gonna get subpoenaed in the inquiry. So what's the point? As I said, we don't have anything to hide. I mean, there can be mistakes that are made, or there can be things that could have been done better, and that's clearly how we learn it. Even if there's absolutely no culpability, that everybody tried to do the best they could at the time, there will be improvements that we learn from later on. I think that I would just say, Chair, we will hand over all the rest of the information as much as we can. But I think we must, I would just respectfully suggest to your good self that this committee should not try to become a preemptor of the inquiry to the arms deal. I think the focus of this committee is on the operation of the NIP, on the improvements we are to make in the NIP program as part of the procurement. And it's that's its focus, I would respectfully suggest. Otherwise we could be going on and on and on and on. And I think that I just want to suggest to the Honourable Hill Lewis that we are not part of any, whether it's a perception or not, trying to hide anything, because we have nothing to hide. We want to, there can be some differences between one report or another, but I don't think that is a question of any malafides on our side, let's look at those things. But I mean, I just wanted to just suggest that there's not a if you're sniffing out the next big scandal, I think you better go and sniff somewhere else.
Right. Thank you, Minister. Well, look, members know I won't take another question, not even a tiny one, because the clarification can come later. Now, what I'm going to do at this point, Honourable Mania, and certainly everyone else, is as I said earlier, it sounded like we were simply getting a first bite. And I think that much is clear. And we want to, broadly speaking, say we welcome this transparency and this the cooperative manner which we've always had, and I've said this to everyone, we've enjoyed this so far, and we would like to continue it. But the reality is, members, while not embarking on the inquiry and trying to do a second inquiry, I haven't been appointed a commissioner or anything, so without doing that, we nevertheless require certain pertinent information. Is that agreed? Now, that pertinent information we've heard expressed here. And I think DTI, the Minister as well, also agrees that there is a need to unpack the benefits. There is. There's a very real need. Because at the moment, confusion reigns. Am I correct? Now, there isn't a member here who doesn't want that. We all do. And may I suggest that you do what I did and spend an entire Saturday perusing earlier committee records since 94. And, yes, they're on the web. You know, some of you are always going to the parliamentary websites and other websites, and I don't know what else. Now, I had to read all of that. And it took me ages, and I had to do all that with without the benefit of even a glass of wine. So, and I can assure you it was tough going. In particular, Minister, when you were chairperson, and I noticed you were querying everything. So very robust, and I mean we want to continue that same robust approach. But however, if there is an inquiry, but that does not preclude us doing our job. But it does preclude us pretending we are the inquiry. I think, but we all understand that. And I'm very pleased we've got on to what I would call an even more strengthened footing as a multi-party committee. And I'm looking at all of you sitting here. The whip included, Honourable Van der Merwe, yourself, Honourable James, leader and not the chairman of the DA, and Honourable Mania, the very hard-working sort of soldier, warrior in this direction of transparency, and yourself, Honourable Hill Lewis, fast joining him. Now, we welcome that. You may not think we do. We do. There's no lid. I've never put a lid on anyone except perhaps the grandchild. And I don't have any grandchildren in this committee. Now, if I can make myself clear, this is a committee of adults. And the DTI have joined us here. No, we do not have everything we require. And yes, we will take up your offer. And I want to suggest, Minister and DG, that we like to set deadlines like yourselves. We don't have these strat plans without a deadline in sight. Now, what we're looking at here is the 25th of April, which is a Wednesday. Now, Minister, that always poses a challenge for yourself. So, what I thought of is instead of that, we looked at the 17th of April, which happens to be the consideration of the first draft of the committee's budget, and we swing, you know, the two around. Now, I'm saying this to members here because all members here should diarise that now. The 17th of April, Tuesday, I hope it's no one's personal public holiday. And I want to suggest 9 o'clock. And being a Tuesday, possibly not 9 o'clock, Honourable Van der Merwe. Some people are living in the Bundus. So what we want to suggest here is it'll be the only item. We're going to suggest 9:30 for 9:45, because some of you will come from the airport. But then you must be prepared to sit until 1:30. I hope I've made myself clear. And I'm relying on yourself, Honourable James, to, you know, communicate that, Honourable Albert, and we'll communicate it to Cope, and the whip will communicate it to the ANC before you see it in writing. So let's make that one clear. Now, for the benefit of those who are here for the first time, we are still pursuing our earlier ruling about the plimptum and demivoirs per se, because while the minister wants to release X and Y, he may indeed do all of that, and we welcome that. But ourselves, we already took the decision. We would in fact have to go to the client, him or herself. I think it must be a man, right? And seek that permission per se. So the basic ruling stands, but we're making sure we get all the information. I hope I'm making myself quite clear. I've asked for a Hansard of this to be expedited, of just this section of the meeting, and made available to members. So there's no misunderstanding of anything. I hope I'm clear there. And then the final point before I'm advised by members that I've exceeded my welcome is that we ought to be thanking each one of you, particularly those who did arrive early and others who joined us due to being in other committees and so on. The departments have been here very early. Thank you very much. The staff have been ready. And, well, you'll announce that as an announcement. And I would then, before I release you, I do want to wish you safe journeys over the Easter period. Let's try and keep things in the red rather than the black then. And spend that time with your families away from political parties. So that at least you have Friday, Saturday and Sunday with your families. And before rejoining the rally ground. Right, can you make the announcement, please?
There's a committee meeting scheduled for the 20th of March, that's Tuesday, starting at 9:30 in the old Assembly Chamber. We will consider or have a strategic plan of the NCC, the CIPC, and the National Credit Regulator, starting at 9:30. The afternoon.
Well, if you go as fast as you went the earlier 2 weeks ago, we'd be finished at 1. That's entirely up to you. On that note then, let me thank the Minister once again, the Department, as well the DG, DDGs, everyone else here, and the staff for their hard work, and which I will not... Oh, just before we leave, let me check our quorum. As we have a quorum... I, regrettably, because I don't like leaving the committee, I am being asked to go to Brussels, to the ACP, EU, and so there I will go, leaving Saturday. And I would certainly like to have someone here look at endorsing the position I want to put on the table, that were the whip chairs, and that we accept that. I'm proposing that. Thank you, Honourable Hildu. Thank you very much for that. It helps me to go ahead and enjoy my Easter after I return. Thank you very much, and safe journey home. In the afternoon. Thank you.